Hello and welcome back to episode 5 of season 2 of the Not God Pod. Thank you for coming back. This might not be episode 5, but I think it's episode 5. So
it's episode five.
Confirmed. Great.
And I like that you have set the tone immediately for potentially the most chaotic episode that will be to date.
It's fine. We're embracing it. Thank you for coming back to listen to the chaos.
Yeah.
Today we have Bethan Bark joining us. Bethan, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello. Yeah, of course. So I'm Bethan. I know Zoe and Billy and everyone from the Not God Complex. We all studied at Rose Bruford together on the European Theatre Arts course. Me and Billy also lived in a flat together in Bratislava. We did Erasmus together, which was so many great things and also so many maybe not so great things. Learning opportunities, because that's the nice way to put it.
The best thing was the show that we did together.
Yeah,
I think.
We devised the show together based on a Grimm fairy tale, which was really, really fun. And also it was really exciting because there was no rules and we were just doing it ourselves, which now as a graduate you just get to do anyway, which is like, oh, this is great. It's
like, oh, I just realized I just realized just as you said that we live together, Burton, that I have lived with both of you, and now I'm just like,
oh yeah,
I sat in this with like ex-housemate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is like nothing. I'm just excited by this fact.
Yeah. No, but so that's sort of how we know each other. But I now work for London Local Authority Council. And I do a lot of different things in that job. So I'm technically a project management apprentice. Which means I'm doing an apprenticeship, so I'm getting a qualification out of it. And project management it's basically the equivalent of kind of directing and producing, but in other concepts. But it's the same kind of jobs. It's the risk management and the budgeting and the basically making sure things happen when they're meant to happen in the right way, which I think you get a lot of that in theatre. Yeah. So yeah, a bit of that. But the team that I work in is strategy and change. So I do a lot of like strategy change management across the council that I work in, which is basically looking at what we do now and what we could do in the future and sort of creating a vision of where we want to be, but then also working out how to get there, how to make other people want to get there too, and how to sort of collaboratively get there together and want to. I've also been really fortunate as a part of my role to work on quite a lot of different community engagement projects, mainly in a sort of supporting and assisting capacity, but I get to sort of, I've got my fingers in a lot of different pies, which is, it's really nice actually. And especially over the pandemic was really great because I just got to see so many different things that I wouldn't have had the opportunity to do so otherwise. So that's what I'm doing at the moment. But my sort of bigger general interest is basically taking the degree we all did, taking the job I do now, and smushing them together and sort of going into the world of looking at theatre in other contexts, managing theatre, producing theatre, working with communities, working with young people, loads and loads of different things. Every now and again, I just scroll on arts jobs and sort of just pick random ones which interest me and then decide that's what I want to do for a bit. And then, you know, so yeah, sort of that's the world that I'm interested in. Yeah, and I guess that's a sort of introduction, a slightly rambly one, but we did say it would be rambly, so
that's the
there
whole
you go
vibe. It's a prerequisite. Yeah. We only invite ramblers on the podcast.
Yes.
Excellent.
Although I must say, I will give you an award if you manage to be more rambly than James.
Ooh, okay.
It's a competition.
It is a competition, yeah.
In the last episode of the series, we're going to have like an awards thing.
We should actually do that.
For like most rambling, most chaotic vibes.
I love that. Well, you may not know this about me, but I'm actually really competitive.
There we go. This podcast is going to be like 90 minutes long now.
Yeah.
I think we need to have one for most like tenuous academic argument as well.
and maybe the one where we ask the biggest question that we end up not answering ever.
That sounds good to me.
Well, this episode I think is well on its way to most chaotic, as we said before. A, the general energy, but B, we have not really decided what we're talking about here. We've kind of just decided to have a chat.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think
so.
Yeah, let's just see what happens.
Okay, I have a question.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Please tell us.
I also seem to have slightly terrible internet connection, so it's okay.
Yeah. Okay.
So we're talking about kind of like background in community engagement and also kind of art as part of that. The question that I guess I'm asking you as our podcast guest, but I also guess just posing to the discussion is like what makes an arts-based community engagement project effective? What do the arts need to do to be community engagement?
A lot of things, but also it's really simple. To break it down, arts-based engagement looks like a million and one different things. It can be a young company, it can be a charity, it can be drama therapy. You might be working with communities and using theatrical practices without literally making a play to talk about issues that otherwise they don't want to talk about. And it exists everywhere and it can exist anywhere and it's massive. I think there's a couple of things, and a lot of the time arts-based engagement looks like one group, probably from a theatre or a charity or even a local authority, which come into a space and want to do something in that space with the people that already own that space. And I think there has to be an understanding of what that relationship is. And I think there has to be an understanding that you're not, so for example, you're not giving these people a voice. They already have it. You might be helping them to amplify it, or you might be helping them to look at it in a different way. But you have to understand that these communities already have all of these resources within themselves. You're just looking at using them differently and introducing new ways of thinking, and that's really important. But honestly, the best way to work with people is to just ask them what they need, and that goes across so many different fields. You know, that goes for running a workshop, that's drama schools, that's just schools in general. If you ask people what they need, they'll tell you. Yeah. And then you can provide it, and then you can have a conversation about the best way to provide it. You know, if you walk into a room and you're doing engagement with a group of people that maybe have a range of disabilities or chronic illnesses, just ask them what they need in that room and give them the space to provide those answers, listen, and then do what they need. And honestly, that's the biggest thing, because I think people go into a space and assume, oh, this group of people are going to be hostile, or well, this group of people will want this thing, and oh, because they're this thing, they won't want to do that. And that's just not helpful. And it's also really restrictive and redactive. So I honestly think people get so scared to ask questions and sort of put themselves in a space where they're putting themselves in a vulnerable position, or they're changing the hierarchy of the room. But you have to do that in order to create a space where things can actually happen. So that would be my biggest point. And that's coming from my arts experience as a participant, as someone who's facilitated rooms, but that's also coming from my experience observing and supporting projects in the council. And there's, you know, there's so many different theories that you talk about, but there's things like community wealth building or understanding assets in a community. And you know, there's so many buzzwords and phrases and stuff like that, but basically they already have everything they need. You're just coming in to look at it differently. But yeah, don't be afraid to put yourself in a different position and compromise yourself. And then I guess another thing which I probably learned from devising more than anything else, which was a very hard lesson to learn, is sometimes you have to give up control totally and just trust in the fact that there is a process and something will happen. We don't know what that something is, and we don't know when it will happen, but it will. And that is really, really hard. But sometimes
I feel like I can hear in. I feel like I can hear very distant Thomas Wilson just yes. being like, ha, ha, finally.
I know.
Yeah, hi Thomas, if you're listening.
For a while. But it is true, and it can be really, really hard to give up that control, but that is the best way to facilitate trust. That is the best way to facilitate engagement, and also just collaboration. So I think that is also a lesson that I've probably learned through observation, but also sometimes the hard way in theatre rooms and rehearsal spaces.
It's just generally like kind of the less like preconceived ideas of how something is going to go, how something is going to work that you have, the less rigid you are with that.
Yeah.
Not in a sense of like don't plan, like do be prepared, but
please
don't
plan.
don't be attached to it. Don't be like rigid with it, because
you don't
know. You have to be responsive. And I think it's also about like there is a reason that in community art settings we use the language of like facilitator as the kind of job role there, as opposed to like kind of
leader.
Directing or leader or those sorts of things that do often look very similar. I think it's important that distinction that your job is to facilitate and to do whatever is required to facilitate the conversations or the creative process or whatever the aim of that particular project is, whether it's to discuss something or to make something or both or whatever, rather than to direct people on how to do it.
100%. And it's more like, right, dodgy analogy time. There may be a few of these.
Go for it. We'll add it to the awards category.
Okay, excellent. If you have a puzzle, right? Like cardboard pieces, funny shapes that you have to fit together to make an image. If you're facilitating a room, what we should be doing is wiggling around those pieces to work out where they fit. But all of those pieces are already there, and that image is already there at the end. We just have to figure out how we want to work towards it. Whereas what you can't do is make a puzzle and rock up with a load of your own puzzle pieces from a totally different set that don't fit in, but you're determined have to fit in, and then you sort of shoehorn them in and you break the bit of card.
Oh, we've lost Zoe.
Oh dear.
Oh no.
Am I back?
We can hear
yes,
you.
Yes, kind of. Okay.
Awesome. Okay.
We were talking about the jigsaw.
Yes.
You don't force people to fit.
And
you
it's
don't bring
great.
Your own jigsaw.
And it
yep.
And it will get you to where you need to be. Is that how you finished?
Yes. Yeah. That's where I was. That was the ramble. That's the point I was making.
Yes.
I think there's also something about community like arts projects that don't have the aim of like getting people into professional arts, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Because a lot of the stuff I personally facilitated on is like young company stuff.
Yeah.
Like 16 to 25 from like particular demographics or backgrounds.
Yeah.
And they're really great projects that the participants like clearly like get what they like are there to get from, but there is an aim towards kind of like professional productions or stuff like NT Connections is like professional productions with but in a community arts setting, and there obviously is like a place for that, and like it's super important that people who maybe wouldn't otherwise have kind of roots into exploring like arts or theatre to say like further in higher education have that. But I also think that community arts can be such a place to be like, let's just do art for the sake of it.
100%.
Because we're human and it's important and it's useful in facilitating these conversations or
And
whatever,
and facilitating conversations and giving people a space to explore things and all of those things, you know. And that's in prisons, that's in schools, that's in hospitals, that's, you know, there's so many different aspects of that. But also for me, it's just fun, like theater, performing, acting, singing, dancing, it's fun. And it should be fun. And I think, obviously, you know, when you study it and you have to write essays about it and it's your career, but also all of your hobbies and everything, you know, it's like that is, it's very all encompassing. And you have to take it seriously because it's your life. But I also think like theatre specifically should be fun. And also like it can be silly and stupid. Like, I think about, you know, the drama games I played when I was in a young company, and they're ridiculous, as they should be. And it's one of those things where, you know, you're learning skills or you're learning text without even realizing, because you're pretending to be a Care Bear wandering around the room, and then there's a blob going on, and then you have to sing or you die, and then it's weird. It's really, really weird, but it's also so much fun. And I think so many people need that outlet to just have fun. And I it's think like that's really
not
important.
Everything needs to be linked to like employability or like, because so often also you hear like art, because of the fact that like arts are not prioritized as something essential to human existing, right? Then there's this whole like competitive funding situation, and you often hear arts argued for in terms of like, oh, it's all of these like transferable skills, and it's like we can just do it for the joy of doing it.
100%.
Because we are human beings, and we are wired to need it.
I mean, like, for forever people have been telling each other stories and people have been singing to each other, and it's like instinctive to want to do those things because it's fun and it feels good, and it feels good to do that with other people. And yes, that has so many other benefits. And yes, like there's all these statistics that you could Google and reel off about, you know, being involved in drama helps you learn languages better, and being involved in this thing means that you've got better collaboration skills, and yes, CV builders, yes, looking at tricky issues, all of those amazing things that theatre and drama can do. But also, it's fun, and we all deserve to have fun.
It's like instead of arguing for like creative spaces and access to creative resources and activities as like a human right, we're arguing for it as like this will let people contribute to capitalism better.
Exactly. It's like we're sort of skirting around the whole thing, and then we sort of ended up in arguing for something we don't really necessarily even want to do, because we feel like we have to convince people.
It's like you can't like, as much as you might want to entirely reject that landscape, you can't, like, that.
That is where we live.
It yeah. exists.
Yeah. And also something that I discovered on Erasmus is, for context, I'm British. I'm pretty standard British, relatively boring, born in London, raised in Bristol, live in London again. Standard, boring, British person, whatever. Went through the British school system. Arts was not there really much, you know. School plays cancelled because our drama teacher didn't want to do them. Like, all of this kind of stuff, you know. And went on Erasmus to Slovakia. And our class was an Erasmus class. So it was people from lots of different countries, loads of different experiences, loads of different cultures. Everyone's drama school, it sounded like, functioned really differently and all of this stuff. And I remember we were in a class and we had to use sheet music. And I was the only person, and Billy was there. I was the only person in the room that couldn't read sheet music. And they were like, but you go to drama school. How can you not read sheet music? And I was like, I've never played an instrument.
I've never been taught.
Yeah, and they were like, but in school, like, did you not have music lessons? Did you not do that?
But it's also, okay, so just in case anyone isn't aware, I am half Croatian and grew up mostly in Croatia. It's not even necessarily like music school. People learn the basics of musical notation in like, just like in music class in regular school.
Yeah. I wasn't doing that. I was not doing that at all. I didn't do any dance. I did, you know, drama GCSE and drama A level, but it was really, I had this realization where I was like, I have not sort of, for someone who, you know, works in the arts and has done an arts degree, I felt like I was like, oh, I know way less about all of these things than I should. But I also think that in the UK, a lot of those things are seen as really inaccessible, like to play an instrument and do grades, or to do dance classes and do grades in those dances.
That's a posh thing.
Dance forms. Yeah. Oh, 100%. Yeah. And you have to have, you know, there's a sort of financial assumption related to it.
And I think because like one piano lesson is like 50 quid an hour.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And you have to like do a very specific curriculum. Yeah. So you also need like a teacher that knows the curriculum and you have to pay to do exams and all of that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you get stuff like, say, like a lot of like acting music degrees.
Mm.
Not all of them, but like a lot of them are like, we want you to have grade whatever.
Yep.
Or at least one instrument. Yep. And it's like you are then literally like excluding anybody who's not like middle class and above kind of a thing from even applying.
Yeah,
exactly. And so many people, you know, and there are things like bursaries or other systems that exist, and there are other ways of doing these things, but they are far and few between. But also so many people wouldn't know those exist.
It's not in the culture, exactly.
And you look at the arts and think, that's not for me, that can't be for me, I'm not allowed to do that. And I just think that's like, that's so rubbish. How that is not an artistic system that is working.
It's like there will be amazing musicians who would like be absolutely incredible like on those programs who have just never sat an exam because
it's expensive.
Yeah, 100%.
Kind of pointless. Like, you know, it doesn't actually do anything except be like a weird, annoying barrier system that you can have the exact same amount of knowledge whether you've been put through that or not.
Exactly. And I think that is a massive barrier. But I also think people just decide that that is not for them, cut themselves off. And I don't think we're doing nearly enough, if anything, to stop that and actually reach out and actually say, no, like, totally come along and do this thing, or, you know, let's enjoy that. Because I think especially music, dance, storytelling is something that is so cultural, and literally every culture in the world has a version of one of those things which they do and have always done. So to sort of tell people they're not allowed to do that and they're not allowed to engage in that, I think is so reductive and so unhelpful. But unfortunately, it's kind of the place we're stuck in almost at the moment.
Yeah. It's that thing I saw, I can't remember what anymore, but recently, I mean, it's circulated around, but I saw it again recently about like how people who are just like born into money, who yes. are rich and for whom money is not an issue.
Yeah.
Something like 80% of them will choose to do art because mm-hmm. if they have the choice, if they don't have any other pressure, I think that's exactly what you're saying. It's like, well, people are yeah. just, we just want yeah. to do art. It just yeah. makes sense to do yeah. art.
Yeah.
yeah.
And it's just, and it makes you happy. And I also think, I totally agree with what you were saying, Zoe, about doing something to do with the arts doesn't mean that you have to want to do it as a career. Like, what yeah. we're not saying is actually scrap all other degrees. Everyone should go to drama school. No yeah. more lawyers allowed. Let's just run around singing and
the world does not need maths
dance
anymore.
With education. You know, like that's not what we're saying. But people should be allowed to do it if they want to, you know, which yes. is pretty low standard.
Which also involves like jobs that are not like creative mm-hmm. being structured in a way that allows people space and time and yeah. financial freedom in their lives to engage with 100%. The arts.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But also the arts being a more accessible career so that people are choosing what they want to choose.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, and the arts being more accessible as a non-career so people are choosing what they want to choose.
Yeah, exactly.
Like yeah. rather than feeling like you either like dedicate your life to the arts or you yes. don't do it.
Yeah, I mean, and even not just engaging and doing workshops or learning an instrument or joining a choir and things like that, but even just going to see theatre, like tickets are so expensive.
Yeah,
and it's like, well, if you look at the price of that ticket and if you look at a cinema ticket, you'd pick to go to the cinema because it's significantly cheaper and it's a big blockbuster and all of that stuff. And going to the cinema is really fun, but it's also like theatres are kind of cutting people off by setting the prices at the point they've set them at. And it's almost like, it's almost really sad to see that they're just fine with that. And they're just fine to sort of be like, yeah, we know certain people won't come see it, but eh.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's not what we want to see really.
No.
Well, that is what the last episode was kind of about. So if anyone hasn't listened yes. to that, go listen to James
yeah, go for
talk
more.
About,
yeah.
about that. Yeah.
yeah. Look at us plugging ourselves. I think there's also something really nice about stuff like at the moment, there's kind of like a weird like internet trend, I guess, and we can get into the like nuances of kind of like aesthetic like internet trend obsessions around stuff, but of people like crocheting and that being like a cool thing
mm-hmm.
and like those sorts of like creative hobbies being yeah. cool
yeah.
Oh
my God,
and it's
yeah.
like you're not doing it for any for like
anything
a particular reason, it's just like look, I embroidered something really badly yeah. like
yeah.
and that kind of yeah like people just doing that because it's like a fun thing to do. And even like yeah. well yeah we can problematize the like trendingness of it all we want, it's also like look, I made a thing, I want to share it with my friends, like that's at the core of that, you know.
Oh, 100%. And it's also like
that's really nice,
really yeah. therapeutic thing to do. Like I remember I took up knitting for a bit in primary school because I had a babysitter who knit and then gave me some like we call them like knitting needles and like a ball of wool. And I wasn't even making anything. I was just making big squares. But it just felt really good, and I'd just sit there and I'd watch like X Factor and Strictly Come Dancing and like squares of fabric. But it just felt like really, I was like, oh, I'm just like doing an activity with my hands and using my body, and that.
Did you
really
guys
good.
Have the, what were they called? It's like plastic
loom bands.
Loom bands, no.
Maybe
Scooby-Doos. Oh.
They were like the loom bands a few years before loom bands.
Oh, okay. I am old.
As someone who's like in the middle of the age.
My age is showing. Thank you. Cool, good, fine, fantastic.
No, like Scoobies were like, you would make like key rings and stuff more, or you could make like friendship bracelets, and they were long.
Yeah. Okay. And it was,
and
like,
you'd make like cube patterns and
there
stuff.
Was millions of patterns, and it was like all this really plastic, they were like plasticky strings, and the best ones were the softer
with
ones
the, like,
with like glitter. Oh, and you could put charms on them and stuff.
Yeah, with the like the early 2000s like gummy glitter aesthetic.
I was obsessed. I think I don't know how long it lasted, but it lasted me a good like 3-4 years, I think, of doing these. Yeah. And it was just like a constant, like my hands were just constantly.
It's just like you make something and then you get to like give it to people or like put it up.
So
good.
Yeah. But it just, stuff like that. It just, it feels good, but also we so instinctively want to do that.
That's why like that's why there is so many of these like trends that are basically just like easy ways for like kids to
to do something.
Right, to make pointless things.
Yeah.
I mean, even it's like the same thing with like cooking. Like cooking was much more fun when I could choose to cook and be like, I'm gonna spend 3 hours making this thing I saw on TV that Mary Berry did, and it's like the most therapeutic thing and it feels amazing. And then obviously, you know, when you have to make food for yourself all the time, it can become a stressful thing and all of that. But like just the action of like making something and then at the end you have a thing which you can do something with.
This is why baking is superior, in my opinion.
Yeah. And so simple, but it just like feels so good to have done that.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, I was having this conversation with someone the other day. I think theater, in my opinion, is one of the only art forms where it doesn't exist as theatre until there's at least two people in the room. Because you can read out a monologue, but until you're either performing or playing with someone or to someone, it's not everything it can be. So I feel like it's something where it's such a beautiful thing to be shared and to create together or to perform together or to have the experience of audience versus performer and that relationship. And it, you know, or even two people sat in an audience and you walk out and you talk about it afterwards and you have really differing opinions and maybe one of you hated it and one of you loved it. But it's so about our relationship to each other and togetherness. And I think it just like, there's nothing else that really puts you in the same headspace, I think. Mm-hmm. But I went to this talk at the Arcola about, it was about like modernizing Shakespeare. So they had a couple of different actors there who had all been in sort of productions of Shakespeare that did modern things with it. And one of the people there talked about how, which I didn't know, apparently when you're sat in a theater and you're watching a show, the entire audience's heartbeat sinks after a certain amount of time.
I heard of this. Is this like is this proven?
I don't know. I hope it is.
Are you sure it's not just because you've been sat still for a while?
Yeah, probably. But like
I don't know if that's a really stupid question, but like well, like your heart rate is lower at rest than not at rest, and presumably you had to like move in some way to travel to the theater.
Yeah. But it's lower, but it's all the same. So it's like,
I don't buy this fact method.
Well, you know what? I like this fact.
So no, it's a beautiful fact. True. Okay.
But it's probably incorrect.
So that, do not quote me on that. I do not know if it's true or not. But the idea is that it's something that brings us together, and this whole group of people are all literally just doing the same thing, which is watching other people, and could all take something totally different from it and could all feel totally different, but still doing that thing together, which I just think is like, yeah, I think that's such a wonderful thing that everyone should have a chance to get involved with in any way they want to.
Yeah,
it's like intersubjectivity, isn't it? Which is basically just like that communication is aided by us sharing an experience. Like I read a study once that basically was about improvements in communication between like general conversation and having to play the same video game and like people who hadn't met each other, because you have a shared frame of reference or experience over which to connect, and theatre or any art is such a good like stimulus or framework for intersubjective communication.
Yeah, 100%.
Intersubjective.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's a nice term. It is a nice term, isn't it? Intersubjectivity.
I like that.
Shall that go somewhere on the tally of the academic terms?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that was quite coherent.
No, that, that wasn't.
No, that was good.
I don't think that was tenuous at all.
No.
Sometimes I'm like, here's a bit of theory. Is it connected to what we're talking about? No.
No, that was relevant. Okay, that was relevant. No, and nice.
That was good. That was nice. I like that.
That's why I'm here, resident academic.
Yeah.
I remember, do you know what? I remember one of the most distinct things about you, Bethan. I don't know if you still hold this view, but when we were making the play that we made in Bratislava, I remember I think you were quite elated, actually, to just be doing something outside of Bruford, outside of like how we were studying. For various reasons, but I remember you always talking about how you believe theatre needed to be a story. It needed to, like, have, like, characters and story structure to... And I think your angle was that, like, more people would enjoy it, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, and that's my experience. And really, funnily, to plug your podcast for you, James, who you chatted to last time, is literally doing a PhD about post-dramatic theatre and class and all of that stuff. So James, if you're listening, you can quote me if you want.
Get us in the reference list.
Yeah, exactly. In my experience, well, to be, you know, not egotistical, but kind of maybe slightly theatrically selfish, I like characters, I like stories, I like those things. I think that they're a really good thing to grasp onto. I think they're often the most, for me, most understandable bit of a piece of theatre which I can latch onto first, and I go, oh, okay, I kind of get what's going on. That's me. I think also my thing that I think of is, if you think of, this is really very British, if you think of the UK, the way that most people are going to be interacting with theatre and seeing theatre is a panto. Mm. And after that, it will be musical theatre, West End shows. That's what most people will see regularly, will be able to see, will be engaging with, will be able to reference, you know. And I understand that pantos are like very British. But as we've established, unfortunately, I am very British. I'm going to have to live with that. But I think having characters and story, it gives you something to cling on to, and it gives you almost, it's something that you can stick with and be comfortable with and understand, whilst everything else around you, you know, you can tell a story a million different ways, you can represent a character in so many different ways, but it gives you this through line. I mean, it almost, so I wrote one of my dissertations using some Brecht ideas. And one idea that Brecht has is the Wolfram Dunst effect, or the V effects, or like alienation, which is that you sort of, you have to do something in political theatre to subvert an audience and kind of make them go, what? because then you're in a different headspace and you're paying attention and you sort of want to engage. And if maybe there's a political idea that comes through, you might be in a space where you're more likely to pick it up. And that's true. But at the same time, if you think about Brecht, all of his plays were parables and stories, and used characters and used stories that we kind of already know and recognize from a variety of cultures, because if there's that thing that we're already comfortable with, the thing that alienates us, the thing that affects us and makes us go, ooh, can be in other spaces. And therefore, in my opinion, it doesn't alienate people to the point that they think it isn't for them anymore. And that's me and my relationship with theatre. And I think theatre at its heart is storytelling. And that means that things which aren't just, you know, telling stories and characters are still storytelling, but that's sort of my connection to it. And that's my way of seeing it. But I also think that theatre, which is totally the opposite and all of that, which I've seen a lot of, is also totally valid, but maybe isn't what I personally would choose to make with people. Mm. If it was their first time ever making theatre, I wouldn't be like, oh, let's use Cantor, that's a brilliant idea. Because I don't know if I understand Cantor, and I wrote an essay on it. So, you know, that's my way of approaching it. And I love fairy tales and grim tales and myths and legends, and all of those things are just like chock full of story and character and metaphor that will never not be relevant. And someone will always find a way to relate to, which is the whole point of storytelling. You know, it's like Aesop's fables or parables, or even, whoa, going pretty big here, the Bible. I took it there. You know, it's stories, and it's using stories to teach something, or it's using stories to talk about an issue that maybe we want to talk around a little bit. And a great way to start using theatre for that is to hang on to the idea of story. And in my experience, that it's also quite fun, and it's a good way to sort of, it's like you've got a rope that you're sort of tethered to, and you know that's going to be there, which also helps you loosen and lose a bit of control, because maybe secretly there is a bit of control which no one needs to know.
Yeah, well, I kind of think so. This project that we are working on. Oh, yes. It's officially been announced. Is this the first time we're recording after official announcement?
I think we mentioned it last time. I don't know if you left it in or not.
I like did the last leave one was in.
Recorded before but released after.
Okay. Well, this is the first time that we are recording after the announcement, though, right?
Yes.
Okay. So for that show, Zoe and I originally kind of thought we might make a script, and then it became something a lot bigger, and because we've never started with a script ever before, we thought maybe not for this one.
Yeah.
for context for anybody who's listening to this but hasn't
listened to
our Instagram post, we have a show on as part of Camden Fringe at the Hope Theatre from the 15th to the 18th of August. It is called What Makes a Body Terrifying, and we're looking at bits of myth and folklore, such as the Selkies, or Billy, what is the Croatian equivalent?
Selke. Slavic, general Slavic, Roselke.
There we go. Looking at myths that are like, yeah, those sorts of figures, and how there's so many of them that are unconnected but very parallel to each other, and looking at what those sorts of repeated narratives and bits of rhetoric can show us about how queer bodies are treated, marginalized, have violence exerted against them, what kind of commonalities and parallels we can draw there. That is the context of the show. You should come and see us.
Yes.
There will be a link to tickets in the show notes of this podcast, and also all over our social media. Bethan will also be creatively collaborating with us, which is also super exciting. And there will no doubt be more podcast chat about our processing things. But that is the context.
That is the
Billy,
context.
You may continue making your point.
Thank you. So my so my point is that we kind of had this idea, and I think I was kind of the one, I think, to suggest it, maybe, just as I was kind of drawn to this idea. And I think actually now that I'm thinking about it and after this conversation, it is maybe that I'm, that there is this like quality of character and story that we so far haven't really done in our work, that I would like to maybe revisit to see what happens. And I'm now excited because Bethan, as we just said, is coming to collaborate.
Yeah.
He is our dramaturg, if we have understood that word correctly.
Yes, so we'll be making sure that we actually have a narrative.
Yes.
Rather than us being like, let's deconstruct, because basically, because we made Rights to Celebrate a Song Goddess, which was kind of a film, but that was very much about deconstructing a character and then placing ourselves in relation it, looking at a kind of mythical figure. And then we also did a piece that was looking at kind of deconstructing a Elena Ferrante novel. And again, that was very much about pulling something that has such a typical trope-filled, predictable in ways narrative apart and seeing how we could like subvert it. So here we're, it's interesting for us because we're very much being like, this narrative is our friend and can tell us so much about how we understand this concept.
And now we're kind of going concept, and I guess it has to go the other way into some kind of narrative. It's still going to be explorative. We're still asking a question. We're still definitely not going to answer that question. But we might have some characters, maybe.
Yeah.
Possibly.
Which will be fun.
Yeah.
And also, like, you can tear things apart and put them back together again, and it will look totally different. You know, you can do so many different things with text and characters and stories and all of that. You know, I mean, when we did, me, Billy, and a couple of people on Erasmus, when we did this show that we did, it was inspired by the stimulus of the Juniper Tree, which is a grim tale, basically about a dysfunctional family, you know, stepmother type thing. The daughter gets her head chopped off. The son dies and comes back as a bird. It's weird. It's really weird. The budget was zero. So we made things work with what we had and sort of, you know, played around with it and all of that kind of stuff. But I think, you know, like a character might be a violin. That violin is now the dad, apparently. You know, and stuff like that can happen, and sometimes stuff like that happens because it has to in terms of the resources you have, but then sometimes having limiting resources can actually encourage a new type of creativity, which so it kind of works in circles a bit, but there's so many different ways to pull things apart and put them back together again.
I'm excited to work on this.
Stay tuned for more music of that in our creative process. Well, we've been recording for 50 minutes.
So good. Okay.
Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much, Bethan, for coming and sharing your thoughts and musings and expertise with us. We will be back next month with another podcast episode. In the meantime, you can find us at The Not God Complex on Instagram and Facebook, at Not God Complex on Twitter. You can email us. Our email is thenotgodcomplex@outlook.com. Things will be linked in the show notes. Our website is thenotgodcomplex.com. We'd love if you have any thoughts, anything you'd like to hear a podcast episode on, please do contact us. Share this episode with anybody who you think might enjoy it. Bethan, do you have anything you want to plug?
I don't know if I do, actually. Well, I mean, there's this show on at the Camden Fringe from the 15th to the 18th of August, which I'm doing with the Not God complex.
Oh, really?
Wow. You know, how exciting.
Which you guys should definitely come see.
I'm a dramaturg. Will be in the show notes.
Yes.
We will be giving you updates on that on our social media as stuff happens, and on this podcast, I'm sure. And yes. We'd love to see you there.
Yeah.
Cool. Thank you for listening. Thank you to Bethan.
Thank you for having me.
We will speak to you again next month. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.